On with the show.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? We are back here with another episode of the Voices Misery podcast. And today I'm very excited. One of my all-time favorite people I have on the show. You guys didn't hear the last one, though, and I have to admit that I did make a boo-boo last time, a big technical error. And it was basically the lost episode, but we're going to make up for it today. My favorite guest of all time is Jennifer Lieberman. She wears many different hats. She wears them all well. She is a very well-versed entertainer, writer, author, also you do so many things, and I can't do you any justice, so I'm gonna have you introduce yourself to the people who may not know who you are. Jennifer, how are you?
Thank you so much. You are too kind, nerd. What a lovely intro. Yeah, so I wear all the hats. I'm an actor who writes and produces to give myself work. And I am also now an author, which was totally unexpected, but that came about also. I guess a lot of things that I've done is just because I was open to a new opportunity. Like that's how I started doing stand-up. I never thought I would do stand-up comedy, but somebody was like, oh, that could be like a good in to network and meet people in Hollywood. And I was like, okay, I'll try it. And then it ended up being a lot of fun. And same with writing books. I never thought I would like write a book. And then I did. And I was like, oh, this is actually fun and takes like a lot less steps than making a film. Like, because writing a screenplay, like you think you like accomplish something, and it is a huge accomplishment to finish a screenplay, but that's only step one of like a 40-step process of getting a movie made and out into the public. Whereas like writing a book, you write it and there's only like three more steps to get it to the public as opposed to like 37. So yeah.
That's really crazy because, and just hearing you say that out loud, it makes me wonder. And my mind just goes 100 different places because a lot of people who are, you know, notoriously good at writing and just really famous at it, they dedicate a lot of their life to it. And you just kind of sound like you just kind of lucked into it. And, you know, I was just doing some research before the show and you're the number one seller on Amazon. And you also, you hear, according to the website Scribblesworth, you had the best rom-com of 2021. You've won awards. So you're really good at this for someone who just kind of looked just, hey, let me give this a shot.
Well, it's so that, okay. Like I kind of gave like the Cliff Notes version, but so I did start writing as a child. I think I might've even mentioned this last time we spoke. So when I was like 8 years old, I started writing, I guess today they call it fan fiction. Back then fan fiction didn't exist, but I wanted to be on TV shows. I wanted to be Zach Morris's girlfriend on Saved by the Bell. So too. I started writing episodes of Saved by the Bell where like I was somebody like a transfer student at the school who got to date, you know, Zach Morris. And I started writing that for like several popular TV shows that I would watch. And so the writing element was always there. Like I did start writing as a child. I wrote a lot of poetry as a child, short stories. And then I did write my first screenplay when I was 12. And I like, you know, I kind of jokingly say that because it's not something I would ever try to sell today. But so I wrote a first script when I was 12. And then when I was 19, when I was in university, I wrote like my first feature film that I was trying to get made in my 20s and it didn't happen. So the writing that always did come naturally to me, but there was always like a performance element to it. And even my poetry, like I've done spoken word and poetry slams and things like that. There was always like kind of a theatrical element to the writing. And my book, Year of the What, was originally a one-woman show. So it was a theatrical piece that got adapted into a novel. So they kind of always went hand in hand. And then like even stand-up comedy, like writing jokes, like I was writing my own material to perform. It all kind of went together, I guess.
Now, you were talking about Year of the What. Now, there's another name for Year of the What. I wanted to ask about the name change. Like, why the name change?
So, it was called Year of the Slut originally. And I actually was talking with somebody in LA, a friend that I had met in a workshop. Her husband owned an agency. And she's like, you got to write yourself a showcase piece, like do a one woman show, because you get to tailor write it to showcase your abilities. And it's a great way to let people know you're here, because I showed up and I didn't have connections. I didn't really know anybody. And I played 10 different characters, and I literally had the title first. I was like riffing, brainstorming ideas, and everything I was telling her, she's like, oh no, that's too artsy. You're not in New York anymore. Cause I was running a little theater company in the East Village. I was like a bohemian artist in New York, you know? And she's like, no, you're in LA. You need like something commercially viable. And I also, because I did theater in New York, knew that the title, like if you could get a great title that just grabs people's attention, then you have a shot at people showing up, you know, because theater, like you can't stream it, at least before the pandemic, you couldn't, exactly. You know, people actually would have to like leave their house and put on pants.
Luckily this camera is only from the waist up for me.
Yeah, exactly. I know, me too. We all go pantsless now in the Zoom world. Nobody wears pants. Exactly. Pants are so overrated. So that title just was like really grabbing and got people to the theater in LA, which isn't really known for being a theater town. It went on. I joke that it was like LA was kind of like La La Land, and like none of the agents and directors who I wanted to come came. Mm-hmm. But I had a vehicle for myself, and I got into a festival in New York, and it won the Audience Choice Award at the festival. And I had no problem buying ads in the Village Voice and Time Out New York. I had no problem getting press. I had no problem getting reviews, getting listings. Like nobody was afraid of sluts in New York. And then when I converted it, adapted it into the novel, I first launched it in 2018 with the original title. And I also think I won the Audience Choice Award because I got a big audience to come. I got butts in seats with pants. So I launched in 2018 and it just fell flat. It was dead in the water because Facebook and Amazon, Instagram, like all social media across the board, including Amazon, the platform that it was published on, did not like the word slut. And I was censored. I couldn't get any ads approved, which meant I could not break through the bubble of my friend group. And, you know, as a creative, it's like, if you think you're going to pack a theater just by selling to friends and family, you're not going to have a successful show. Same with a book. You know, you don't have enough friends and family to go around to make a book a number one bestseller or to, you know, make your money back even.
Exactly.
So it was really such a hard place to be at, because after a year of like, you know, being dead, complete failure, a colleague of mine was like, change the title. And I was like, no, but the title is why it's successful. The title is like everything, mm-hmm. You know, because it's like people hear that title and they're like, ooh, what's that about? Yeah. And most people that hear the title can clue in that it's like a feminist piece, that it's a sex positive piece, that it's not a slut shaming piece. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it took me a few months. It took me rereading Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich, which I do every so often, every few years. And I started reading around Christmas time, and it was literally New Year's Day of 2020 that I was reading the chapter about the guy who couldn't sell his book and then changed the title and it became this like huge success. And I was like, okay, universe, like it's not a coincidence I'm reading this on New Year's Day. So, so I listened and I was able to like turn my failure into a success. And like you said, it hit number one bestseller on Amazon and I've won a couple of awards for it, including best rom-com of 2021, which I'm just like, what? Me? What? But yeah, so it's been a journey, but it's also kind of like a lesson of not to give up on yourself. Like you, when you believe in something and you know you have something of value to share, you know, you don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater and start from scratch. Sometimes you just need to like rebrand or revamp or, you know, try a different audience or, you know, whatever it may be.
It makes perfect sense. But I do want to ask you about this one woman show thing, because I mean, to me, that just sounds insane. Like who would want to perform a one woman show? How many people are showing up to this kind of a thing? And how do you get yourself in the mindset? Cause you got to play all these different parts. Do you change your voice, different name?
Yeah. I never thought I would do a one woman show. Like I had been running a theater company in New York. I had access to like, I had passes to the Fringe Festival and things like that. I had industry passes. So I'd see one person shows. I saw some fabulous one person shows. And every time I saw a one person show, I was like, wow, I could never do that. Like I could never. And then when I moved to LA, I was taking an acting class as us actors do. And I met a woman in class, Mina Oliveira, who is blowing up. She's got like a TV series in Brazil that's also like available on streaming in the US and some feature films now. But she had a one woman show called Latina on the Loose. And she was practicing her pieces, just pieces of it in class. And I just thought she was fabulous. She was so good. Like the writing was great. The story was great. All of her characters were amazing. And I just was like, I am new in town. I don't have any connections, but I am a theater producer. And I think you're so talented. I'll help you any way I can for free. And I did. And she got picked up by the LATC, which is a big theater company downtown. And they paid for her to do like a full scale run. And she won awards for the show. Like it went on to be this huge success. Rightfully so. Like she deserved it. She's amazing. Mm-hmm. And then another woman who was in class with us, or not class, there was a theater company also that kind of, that class turned into a little theater company, Susanna Brisk. And she was doing a one woman show called Momified about being a mom and about how like, once you have kids, it doesn't matter what you do for the rest of your life, you're doing it as somebody's mom. And she also had a fabulous show and she was impressed with how I helped Mina and hired me to be the associate producer on her show. Once again, she was brilliant, fabulous, amazing comedian, amazing writer. And I was just like, I am not that kind of actor. Like, I think I'm a good actor, but I'm not, I could never do that. And it wasn't until somebody whose husband owned an agency in LA sat me down and said, this is what you have to do. And then I was like, okay. But that's how I've done everything. You know, somebody told me I had to do a one-woman show. Someone told me to do stand-up comedy. Someone told me to write a book, you know, and I was like, okay, well, you know, it's, you know, like if that's going to open the door that I want to get through, why not? And I never thought that I had that kind of a talent. And then when I started writing it, I was writing it in my living room and I call it Magic in the Living Room. And that's something I write about in my blog and in a couple of my how-to books. Because if you can't make magic in your living room, you're not going to be able to make it anywhere else.
I agree. That's yeah. I mean, who isn't comfortable in their own living room?
Exactly. And that's the thing, like, you know, every artistic endeavor kind of starts in the living room. It doesn't matter if it's, you know, a musician with their guitar. Okay, fine. Maybe they're in the garage, not the living room, but it's, you know, it's never in like an ideal circumstance of, you know, having the team around you and having the theater and have it all starts, you know, at home. So I was just starting to write this story loosely based on my life. It started based on my life about like the year after my first heartbreak. And then just kind of took on a life of its own because these characters started coming out of me, because I was like, okay, I could do this accent and that accent, and I could play this person and that person. So I tailored it to do that. And I ended up playing 10 characters, and it ended up writing itself at a certain point. And these characters would come out of me, and they'd literally, like, I'd be like looking around. I'd be like, where did that come from? What? Who is that? Like, you know, and it ended up being so much fun. And I also realized, like, I had spent so much of my adult life in my career trying to get the role, trying to get the audition, trying to get the agent, trying to. And so much of your time is wrapped up in that you're not actually doing your craft and focusing on the work and pushing yourself to the next level. And that's what happened with the show. I was like, wow, I am writing every day. You know, even days that I had to go to work, I was managing an office at a steel brokerage firm in Beverly Hills at the time, you know, but I'd come home and evenings and weekends in my spare time, I would be writing the show and working on these characters and accents and physicalities and different ways to embody the story. And I totally blew myself away. And I always say that's the best part of the creative process, is when you get to surprise yourself with your own ability. And that's what happened with this show. So that was a long-winded, you asked several questions. People came, people from my acting class came, and some friends that I had met came, and some of them brought some friends. So we did have pretty good houses. I was doing it in a 99 seat theater, and it was at least half full. For the first run was just 4 performances. I didn't even attempt to do it on a weekend. I was like, I'll do it on the nights that, you know, like on a Tuesday and a Wednesday that your actual, you know, play isn't happening. Sure. And I think there was Orpheus Descending going on in that stage on the actual nights. And then I took like I don't remember if it was Monday, Tuesday or Tuesday, Wednesday. But people did come, and I ended up partnering with this amazing director who like ran the theater space. So, you know, he gave me a great deal on doing rehearsals in the theater. I was just going to do them in my living room. And he's like, I'm at the theater all day anyways, like just come here and, you know, we'll negotiate a good rate. Yeah. And it all just kind of worked out.
Now, the thing about it is, when I think of a writer, I think of someone who's afraid to come out of their house, just like we've all been doing for the past 2 years, supposedly, right? You know, don't leave your house. You know? So I always think of someone very introverted, as someone who's afraid to showcase any kind of emotion or just any personality. But you're out there, you're writing, and you're going out there in front of the camera and doing things in front of audiences and stuff like that. So I just want to know, like, where this personality come from? Was this always inside of you at a young age? Because you were saying how people tell you to do these things. So where did this come from?
I was always, I just want to qualify, because there are so many like actors who do write. And yes, there are a lot of writers who are, you know, more on the reclusive side and just, you know, like to kind of, hide behind the world of their stories and things like that. And, you know, hermit like people, but there are so many writers, especially in Hollywood, that create their own projects, like John Leguizamo wrote several one-man shows. He's the king of the one-man show. He's like best, you know. And if you look at like Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, like they wrote Good Will Hunting to give themselves a vehicle. Like they weren't getting the parts that they wanted. They weren't getting the opportunities that they wanted. So in Hollywood, even Chaz Palminteri, he wrote A Bronx Tale. That was his one-man show that got made into a feature film, My Big Fat Greek Wedding. Nia Vardalos was, you know, it was a one-woman show that got made into a feature film. So the one-person shows are a stepping stone to success, and a lot of people have had an opportunity to break in with them. So it's not like I was doing something that, like, I wasn't forging a new path. Like, it had been done before. I did, you know, mine's not a feature film, but it's a novel, and that's pretty cool. But yes, I've always been pretty outgoing. Like, even as a child, I used to, like, go up and talk to strangers. Like, I was, like, 2 or 3 years old, and my mother would be like, my mom would be like, you can't, don't talk to strangers. But she didn't explain to me what a stranger was. So I'd go up to everyone and be like, are you a stranger? Are you a stranger? Can I talk to you? Are you a stranger? So I was always pretty outgoing. I don't think I was ever shy. I think I'm more shy as an adult than I was as a child. And then I was also a competitive gymnast. So I was used to performing in front of people. I started competitions when I was 5. So I was very young and very used to being in front of people and being judged.
Oh yeah, that's the worst, because you're sitting there, you're killing yourself doing all these flips and stretches and things, and then someone's like, yeah, 7.
That was, yeah, exactly.
Son of a bitch, who do you think you are?
Yeah. And you look at these judges and you're like, okay, you go do it.
Exactly.
You go do it. Like, let's see you do, you know, do back handspring, you know, combo into like a split jump on the balance beam. Let's see you do it.
Why do all the judges look like the least qualified people to do any of that shit? They're always like overweight. They're like eating McDonald's and drinking a goddamn big gulp as they're watching these kids do all these things. Like who are these people?
You know what? I think a lot of them spent enough of their life starving themselves in training that they're just like, forget it. Forget it. I'm eating McDonald's. Like, I spent, you know, 12 years of my life, like, eating, you know, a cracker and an apple every day. And like, I'm just eating McDonald's for the rest of my life now.
I have a really interesting fact that you don't know, okay, about the show. Is that you are the first, and I just found this out a little while before we came on to do this show here. You're the first African ever on the show.
Really?
The first. And I'm like, wait a second. You're from, so you have, and your mother's from there, right?
My mother is from Tunisia, North Africa.
Okay.
And her family lineage goes back over 2,000 years. My grandfather's lineage predates Christ.
Jeez,
on the island of Gerba. Okay. Yeah. So I, in my stand-up, I talk about it. I'm an African-Canadian ginger Jew. And
what a mix.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. But my mom and her brothers were all born in Tunisia, and then they came over when she was a child. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty, like, I love it because the culture and the food, oh my God, Tunisian food is like the best. I don't know if you've ever had any, but it's a lot of stews over couscous, but Moroccan couscous has like more dates and raisins and nuts. It's more savory. Tunisian cuisine is more, Moroccan is more sweet. Tunisian is more savory and a lot of spicy sauces. Like, if you've ever heard of harissa, or as we call it, arisha, it's like a chili paste that's become trendy now. So some of the hipster restaurants use it as like a hot sauce spread. And my grandmother, God bless her. She had 6 kids. My mom was the only girl, 5 boys. She spent her entire life in the kitchen just cooking meals, because by the time she finished cooking one meal, she had to start, she had to feed an art like a football team every day.
Oh, God.
3 meals a day.
That's tough. Oh my goodness. But then, you know, so she ended up in Canada, mm-hmm. where you were born. And I have to ask you about Canada, because holy shit, you guys are going through some stuff right now. It's bad in Canada right now that I heard that last week the McDonald's house was kicking out unvaccinated children. They gave them like a deadline for these kids to get vaccinated or get kicked out of the McDonald's house. Absolutely insane. What's going on? Can you speak to what's going on up there?
So I'm not a big fan of Trudeau to begin with. And he, you know, the legacy of his father, I think, is what made people think he would be a good idea. That in combination with legalizing marijuana. I definitely believe like the marijuana vote is what got him into office, mm-hmm. you know, because there's so many young people and millennials who that was their first time voting and they wanted to vote for this cool guy who like, you know, is hot and does yoga and smokes weed and, you know, so, yeah, but he's just not, he doesn't really represent the wishes or the needs of the people. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's gotten pretty crazy here. We're not as bad as Australia, but we're currently locked down. So restaurants are not open, gyms, no activities. Basically the only thing that's open are grocery stores, and retail, but only like 50%, whatever, it's fine. But at this point, it's like, well, you killed all the mom and pop shops already. So the only retail open are the big box stores and, you know, like the big chains. So, but yeah, you can't really go out and do anything, especially because it's freezing. There's over 2 feet of snow on the ground right now. We had a big, huge snowstorm. And this is Toronto. So Toronto is like the mildest. You know, we're like the southern tip of Canada. We're pretty mild, but like Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta, Quebec, like they're all buried and way colder than we are here. So, so that's the thing. You can't even like go out and meet people. Oh, and they've limited gatherings inside to 5 people. And I was just like, well, what if you have 4 kids?
Yeah,
like, exactly. You have to put one in the garage. Like, I don't understand.
Or you can put one in the trunk of your car, like women down here do. They put their kids in the trunk of
their car. Oh my God, that was insane. Yeah. The vaccine mandates, I don't believe in vaccine mandates. I believe everybody should have the choice to do what's good for them.
Me too.
So I'm going to say this, even though maybe I shouldn't. So, that we have, like a genetic thing in our family that makes you predisposed to blood clots. Sure. And some of us have it, some of us don't. And, like my mom has it, she's predisposed to blood clots. She'll be on blood thinners for the rest of her life. They found it like 15 years ago. And once they kind of found that in her, they had her tell her siblings and then have them all tested and then all of the kids tested and everything like that. So, one of my cousins who's young, 21, very healthy, very strong, got his booster and was diagnosed with a blood clot in his lung. And, that was about a week or two ago. And, it's really hard because, even if you know you're predisposed to blood clots, that's not an exemption from being vaccinated. Like there are basically no exemptions. I took my mom to the doctor a couple of days ago and they even had like a sign up saying, you know, all these things are not exemptions from getting the vaccine. And it's just hard because there are people who are predisposed, who have conditions, you know, that put them at risk. And I think the vaccine is great for people who are, you know, vulnerable, who are older, who are at risk, who feel safe, who want to get it. But I also think there should be the option of people saying, I have other conditions and I'm not comfortable with this vaccine because I don't know how it's going to interact with my other pre-existing stuff. So, So it's a hard one. It's a hard one. And like, people in my family have called me an anti-vaxxer and I'm like, I'm not an anti-vaxxer because I believe in lots of vaccines, but this particular vaccine, we don't have a long enough track record for it to be like a blanket solution for everybody.
Exactly.
And I know like, I'm going to get canceled now, but you know what? I was never picked up. So I don't care about getting canceled.
Join the club. That's why I don't give a shit. I mean, I'll say it. And like you said it in a much nicer way than I'm going to say it. I'm just not getting it because I don't want it. I don't need it. I'm young. I'm in decent enough shape. I take care of myself. I watch what I eat. I have a treadmill that I run on every now and then just to keep in shape. And I'm doing the right thing. I feel like I shouldn't have to do it, but I'm not going to fault someone for doing it.
Yeah, I agree. Young, healthy people. I did get double vaccinated. My mother has had a series of surgeries. And in order for me to be able to go in the hospital and be a caregiver and be a full-time caregiver for her, I chose to get the vaccine so I could be available to take care of my mother But I told my parents that if I was not here helping the family, that I would not have gotten it. Like, you know, just because we don't have long-term data on reproduction. We don't have long-term data on offspring. And, you know, there are reports like right, left, and center, every country, every city is having like hospitals where half of their staff are out because of Omicron. And I'm just like, so the vaccine's not effective?
Mm-hmm.
Not really doing what it's supposed to do?
Yeah, they're really not. And the thing is,
but nobody wants that. But God forbid you say something like that.
Exactly. But there are people that are testing positive that they're saying, you know what? As long as you're vaccinated and you test positive, come back in to work. We need you. Just keep on working. Who cares? That's what they're doing down here. So what about the people that are unvaccinated and healthy and unemployed? Why don't you just call them back?
None of it is making sense to me at all. And that's the thing also, but also like I'm difficult. I'm a difficult person because I think for myself and I never go with the grain. Like I'm the type of, I've always, even like when I was a kid, if everybody's doing it, I'm not.
Same. I always put up my walls whenever someone keeps telling me something, here, take this. It's free. It's good for you. Don't worry. Don't ask any questions about what's going inside of you. Don't ask any questions. It's okay. It's safe.
I'd rather pay for something that like I actually want than take something for free. Like even in the mall, when people are always trying to give me like free samples and free cream and free hair. And I'm like, no, thanks. You know, like, no, thank you. I'm always questionable about those things.
How has it affected you though, personally, with, you know, trying to just build this career for yourself where you're getting out there, you're doing the shows, you're writing books, you have to go out there with PR.
Miss my people. I miss my community. I miss my life, you know, it's hard. Like, and also because I've been staying with my parents and helping out, I've not been able to make decisions that I would normally make if I were on my own, because I would take a lot more risks if I were on my own. Sure. But God forbid I bring something back to my parents. Like I would never want to put them in that situation. It's been hard. Like, you know, I've only done stand up once. I was in LA in the spring and I did stand up in Inglewood. I was the only white girl, all black show, all black audience. One of my buddies,
big. You're more African than all of them.
Exactly. But my buddy, Big Bad Bo Hawkins, like we came up together at the Comedy Store years ago. Like we both did our first show together. He saw that I was in LA. I went to a show that he was performing at. He's like, you want to come do another show in Inglewood? Cause I'd always do the shows when he'd ask me. And he's like, you know, most white comedians don't want to come down to Inglewood. Like, you know, they're intimidated or they're this or that. And I'm like, hey, look, like if I'm funny, I'm funny. Like if I can't be funny for a black audience, then I'm not a comedian. Yeah. Like what are you talking about? So I went and like, I had a great show. It was lots of fun. And exactly, everyone's always kind of blown away when I talk about being African, because people look at me and they're like, what? No, you're not. And it's like,
The whole stand-up comedian thing, this is my biggest gripe with stand-up comedians, and just female ones in particular. And it's not like I don't think female comedians are funny. Some of them are really hysterical. But I've noticed one trend, and it seems like a lot of the well-known ones, they all go down the same path. They do the whole, you know, oh, I'm an alcoholic. I'm a whore. Oh, I sleep with so many guys. Oh, this is me. And that's their whole shtick. And it's like, you've seen one, you've seen them all. So a lot of them turn me off. I guess that Nikki Glaser, I guess you can call her the pioneer. She's not the pioneer, but she's the most famous out there one who does the whole sex as a crutch.
Yeah, and Amy Schumer was, but she kind of had her fall from grace.
Yeah. And, what's your style?
So actually it's really interesting that you bring that up, because when I started doing stand-up, I started doing it in like 2014, and it was right before Amy Schumer like exploded. Yeah. And somebody, I submitted to a casting notice I didn't know it was stand-up comedy. It was just looking for girls who were cute and funny. And I was like, I can be cute. I can be funny. Okay. What's the job? Yeah. And it was a comedian, Matt Taylor, who is a promoter and has a bunch of shows. And he was like, I don't have enough female comedians on my shows. And I'm looking for females who are willing to do stand-up comedy, and I'll help you. I'll help you with your first 5 minutes. I'll give you some tips. I'll coach you. And I had already done my one-woman show at that point. So prior to the one-woman show, I would have been like, no way. But after being on stage like an hour and 20 minutes by myself, I was like, oh, what's 5 minutes? You know what I mean? If I bomb, I bomb. And that's when I started doing it. And I did. I was doing dirty comedy. I was, you know, making fun of, like, you know, what's up with the beard? You know, you guys made the beaver extinct in modern society, and now you got bush on your face. Yeah. And I know it's not because you're lazy, because you all shave your balls, you know? So, like, that's the type of stuff I started with. And then when Amy Schumer broke, I was just, I kind of took a step back and I was like, okay, Jennifer, if you're going to be known for something, what do you want to be known for? And I was like, not that. And that's kind of what took me on this, on this journey. So I was, George Carlin is my favorite comedian slash philosopher. Like, I think Amazing. He's kind of the king. He's the best, the I best. Wish best.
I wish we had him nowadays.
Well, you know what? Everything he said back then is more valid than ever now. So Absolutely. Just keep listening to him. He's like the, you know, truth.
Yeah.
He's the word of truth. So that's when I started. And also 2014 was around the time that I became vegan and I became more conscious of things. Like, I'd been vegetarian my whole life, almost my whole life, since I was 12. But I never thought there was a problem with, like, dairy and eggs. And, you know, so my mind was opened a little more. Don't watch any factory farming videos if you ever want to enjoy food.
God. I ruined my night one night watching that stuff. I'm like, yeah, I'm gonna try the vegan thing. And I went one day without a steak. I'm like, nah, I gotta go back.
Yeah, no, exactly. It just depends how sensitive you are. I'm pretty sensitive. So, like, you know, I accidentally ruined my life with that. So, so then I just kind of started working on talking about things that mattered to me. But I also remember, like, watching Tiffany Haddish in an interview when she was a kid. She went to, like, she was able to go to, like, a comedy camp where Bill Cosby was teaching. I know, ooh, Bill Cosby. But he was saying, like, you can talk about anything on stage as long as it's funny, but nobody's going there to listen to your problems. If you can make your problems funny, you can talk about them. You know, so that interview really, like, stuck with me when Tiffany was talking about that. And I was like, okay, that's right. So it's like, I can talk about veganism. I can talk about the environment. I can talk about the things I want to talk about as long as I figure out how to make them funny. And, you know, so I, like, talk about, you know, how I'm a vegan, but, like, you'd never know. You just think I'm anorexic. You know, you can take me to dinner. I'm not one of those, like, bitches who's going to give you a hard time, you know? So, and then I was able to kind of, like, riff from there and come up with, like, a whole shtick. And, you know, and I still wear leather. I still wear, you know, I'm not going to throw out all my shoes in my bags. So, like, you know, was able to, you know, come up with that. But yeah, I also noticed after Amy Schumer broke, a lot more females getting into the comedy thing. Mm-hmm. And everybody talked about dating, sex, you know, it was like the same jokes in different, you know, variations, but it was a lot of the same. And for me, I was doing those jokes when I was insecure, because it was easier to get a laugh with the dirty stuff.
Absolutely.
But also, lazy.
Yeah.
A lot harder to come up with funny material that's clean. And that's about things that aren't dating and aren't about how guys are this and guys are that. And that's the other thing too. Like, I I am so not like a man hater. And I actually like, I feel like the feminist agenda has gone so far that it's not about bringing women up anymore. It's all about pushing men down. And I'm not about that. Like, I love men. I think men are wonderful. And that's the thing. It's like, I love my dad. I love my brother. I love my granddad. I love my cousins. Like, these are all men. They all have an important place in the world, just like women do. And so, yeah, that's another thing. Like, I just wanted to get away from like the man-hater material. And I just wanted to like talk about things that were important to me.
Yeah. I find it interesting when you say about the feminist movement, because I don't think it's gone far enough, to be honest with you. I think we need 10 times more. And I'm going to tell you why, because I feel like, and I'm a father.
10 times more feminist.
I think they need to ramp it up with the feminism. I think we need more of it, because I got two girls and I have a wife. Obviously I have two female dogs. I love women. Right. And I feel like, and I don't know how things are in Canada, but here it feels like women are being forgotten about. They're being marginalized, where men can do a better job of being women than women. They took away childbirth. Now anybody could do that.
Well, you know, that's the trans agenda. That's a whole other story.
I hate this. Did you see that swimmer, that guy who like, I'm a girl now, just kicked the shit out of all these women. And like now they're going on to some other tournament. We're going to beat everybody there too, when they were just a mediocre male swimmer. Stuff like that irritates me.
Yeah. And especially like as an athlete, as a female gymnast, like female gymnasts will never do male gymnastics, you know, like especially like the rings and the pommel horse. There's a reason females don't have those events. We have different events in female gymnastics because our bodies are made differently. Mm-hmm. And if you notice female gymnastics, like, you know, it's very rare for a woman now. There have been some trailblazers, but women who are over 20 going to the Olympics. But it used to be like, you know, by the time you hit 20, your career is over. Yeah. Whereas men's gymnastics, men can't, like I was competing in the, you know, provincial championships when I was like 9, 10, 11 years old. Men at that age are barely capable of doing basic skills in male gymnastics, like doing the iron cross on the rings and, you know, just half of the skills, because they need to be developed with that upper body strength in order to be able to do it. And I was a beast. Like I'm small. I'm like 5'1" and I'm quite petite now, but you know, when I was like 10 years old, I was a beast compared to all the other boys. I actually held the chin-up record at my high school when I was in ninth grade, when I was a freshman, for doing the most chin-ups in a row. But even as beastly as I was, you know, as like a young tween and teen, that could never compete.
Yeah.
Like me at the peak of my career could never compete with a male at the peak of his career, just because of biology.
Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous. And there's things that we can accept as human beings with, you know, just common sense. Like, I know I'm a man and I know you're a woman. There are things you can kick my ass in, there are things I can kick your ass in, but we both know that and accept that. We're not delusional about it, where everyone's in the same playing field. And I guess it's just the way the world is now. It's crazy and just insane.
No, and the thing is, I understand that, you know, things are changing. We're always evolving. Society's evolving in a certain way right now. And my best friend came out when we were in freshman year of university, and I went to the gay clubs. I marched in the gay pride parade for years and years and years to support him. But also, this was before gay marriage was legal. This was, you know, before there was a lot of equality. And it's like, okay, now we have gay marriage, and now, you know, everybody is for the most part treated equally and not discriminated against. Like, look at Oscar Wilde, who was like persecuted for being homosexual, you know, over 100 years ago. He was a brilliant talent, but couldn't live as he was. And that's the other thing too. I think trans people are human beings who deserve dignity, and they deserve respect, and they deserve to live their lives peacefully without discrimination, 1000%. But I think biological men competing in sports against biological women is a line that does not need to be crossed. Because like you said, if you know, there are enough trans women at a school, not a single biological woman would get on the team.
Yeah.
Right now it's you know, there's a small percentage in the school, so it's not enough to eradicate all of the women from sports. But if the numbers go up, women will be completely eradicated. And I'm thinking maybe it's time to have another category. Maybe it's time to have another, because I think these people definitely are entitled to compete. They're entitled to have competition. They're entitled to, you know, to excel in sports.
I agree.
But unfortunately, you know, you're tossing these women to the side, and it's really unfair.
It is. It kind of makes me wonder, and I don't even know if this is a good analogy to make, but you know how you have the Olympics and you have the Special Olympics. Maybe just give them, and I'm not saying that they're special needs or anything, but just give them their own
category.
Their own, and I have no problem with that. A third bathroom, do what you got to do. Just don't marginalize women because you want to create this the sense of unity when you're really just kicking women to the curb. I don't like that. I'm just not good with that.
Yeah, exactly. And so for me, just across the board, one of my biggest pet peeves in life is when people try and normalize the exception. And it's, you know, and I'll just use an example of when I was producing a play. I was producing a play and I sent the director the newspaper listings. Well, not newspapers, online, but, you know, for like an online publication, all the listings of the plays that were currently happening, because not every play gets into the listings. And I showed him all of the photos, and the photos were supposed to be photos of the play, like, so a still of what was happening on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
And out of maybe 50 listings, there was one that wasn't on the stage, and it was like on a location somewhere, and they took a cool photo. Yeah. And he was like, yeah, you know, we're going to do something like this. And I'm like, no. Like 49 out of 50 pictures are pictures of, you know, a frozen scene actually from the play. Like, why do you have to look at the one exception and try to be the one exception? Like, you know, and it just bothered me because I had so much more experience as a producer, and I knew what it kind of took to get that photo, you know, what the photo needed to be in order to get into the listings. And he kept on just pushing for, and I was like, look, we can do both, but we still need some tableaus of actually what's happening on stage. And like, that's a thing in life. It's like, I understand that, you know, there are certain people who have these needs and have these, you know, have these things in life and have made these choices, but they're the exception. And why do we have to make that small exception of the population into the norm?
Yeah.
I just don't understand that. Like, I don't understand why children, need to learn. Like, I think my niece was in first or second grade when they were reading the book about jazz, about her being trans. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, why is this appropriate for grade one or grade two?
Yeah.
And not that children should never learn about it or it should never be addressed, but I don't think small children at that age really need to know about it. I think, okay, fine. If your parent is trans, then you need to understand it. And that's a conversation that your parents are going to have with you. But out of the entire population of the country, how many children do have trans parents?
Yeah.
So why does every single child need to be exposed to this information that's completely superfluous to them?
Yeah.
Until they're at an age where they can actually compute it.
It's this all or nothing approach with everything that they do now. Everything's all or nothing. It's like, okay.
It's like the vaccine, all or nothing.
Exactly. I was just going to bring that into play here. It's all or nothing. And it's crazy because you're trying to get them at a young age. It's like you're trying to create more. I understand. Kids need to know this, but It's way too fast, way too soon. I mean, I'm a little bit older than you. I mean, I'm 39. You're 21 years old, obviously, right? So
obviously,
right? So my thing is, when I was a kid and I would go to the grocery store, you know, my family and whatnot, and if we were in line and we saw a dude with a beard and a dress on, they'd say, what the hell's wrong with him? And this is going back when I was a kid. This is like the late 80s, early 90s. And, you know, that wasn't that long ago. It really wasn't. And nowadays you see that you're supposed to be like, that man is, no, that woman is brave. And now you're this warping everything that we learned just not too long ago. And now you're just changing it like complete 180. And we're supposed to just accept it. Of course, you're going to get pushback. It has to be gradual. If you're going to accept or force people to accept this new normal that you want us to do, you're not just going to beat everybody into submission and cancel words said on the internet. If someone doesn't like what you're trying to portray to them. I it's just crazy. And it kind of leads me into the question I wanted to ask you about this, the way things are nowadays, is how often when you're creating these characters and this content that you're putting out there, how often do you sit there and say, okay, I have to check this box, I have to check back that box, because that's what is reflected in society now. I have to, you know, basically mirror what's going on in real life.
You know, it's funny. I've never thought that I had to check any boxes, and I'm not going to like let society dictate the type of work that I do. But also, just because I am a curious person and I do want to have conversations that I know I can't really have in public, I have started putting those things into my work so I can have so the characters can have conversations I can't have. So that's something that I have started to do. And you know, and also, you know, each character is going to defend their truth. So I'm going to give everybody the dignity and the respect that they deserve, but it's just a forum for me at this point to have conversations. Like, you know, when I wrote Year of the Slut, this was before the whole Slut Walk incident. I don't know if you ever heard of Slut Walk, but it was like,
Amber Rose, right?
Pardon?
Was that the
Amber Rose took it to LA, but actually Slut Walk broke out at the university I went to in Toronto called York University, because there was an escalation of sexual assaults and rapes on campus. And the faculty decided to bring in a police officer to talk to the girls about campus safety. And this ignorant man said to the student body, if you don't want to get raped, don't dress like sluts. And that was the catalyst for Slut Walk. And I believe the first Slut Walk was in February or March of 2011. And that was when I was first performing the show. So it was one of those things, like I chose a subject matter that was, that just got really heated, you know, and I always wanted to pick something that means something to me. You know, I know as a female, as a young female, people throw the word slut around as a weapon. That's how they attack you as a woman. It doesn't matter what you're wearing. It doesn't matter whether you're promiscuous or not. That's just one of those blanket statements people use to attack you. And that's why I wanted to write a piece about it. But also, the piece isn't about any characters being slut shamed. It's actually about the protagonist reframing her idea of what a slut is, because in her head, sleeping with any more than one man that you were going to marry would make you a slut. You know, so she has this kind of awakening and realizing, like, wow, I was not living in the world that I'm actually in. She was living in some, you know, idyllic fairy tale land that doesn't really exist anymore. You know, maybe it did 100 years ago, but it does not exist now. So that, you know, so I was deconstructing that idea, and not from an outside point of view, but from the own character's point of view. And book two in the series, now that I have a book, there's going to be a book two. So book two is going to be Year of the Bitch. Another word that's used as a weapon as women mature. When we're younger, we're called a slut. As we get older, we get more assertive. You know, maybe we're in a manager position, we have to delegate. Now we're called a bitch. Now, anytime we want to assert ourselves or We want to, you know, assert some sort of authority, or we're in an authoritative position. Now we're a bitch. Whereas a man would just be doing his job. So those are certain things that I wanted to explore. And then even in my last short film that I made is called Details. And I wrote it. It's about a couple that whose relationship is deteriorating. I wrote it as a heterosexual piece. I'm heterosexual. I wrote it as a heterosexual piece. And then there was a girl I met in acting class, and we really wanted to work on something together. And I was like, hey, I have this piece. I think it's pretty good. And it's between a male and a female, but it could easily be between two females. So for the sake of acting class, we did it as a lesbian piece. And then I was offered to do it in a showcase. And then I did it as a straight piece. So like I did it when we did it as a lesbian piece, I took the male lines and she took the female lines, because it was just one of those arguments that any couple could have. Anyone could be the male. Anyone could be the female. It was about infidelity. It didn't make a difference. So I had done it as a lesbian piece. I had done it as a straight piece. And then I had an opportunity to shoot it. And it had fell through like 6 times in 10 years. Because everyone who read the script loved it. And so many people would be like, okay, I want to direct this. Let's make this happen. And then it would just, you know, after a few weeks, fizzle out the excitement, or they'd get another project or whatever. Finally, I get a chance to make it. I can't decide. Do I want to do it as a straight piece? Do I want to do it as a lesbian piece? What do I do? So I actually decided to shoot the exact same film several different times. And I shot it with 4 actors, which ended up being 4 different couples. So each actor got to play it straight and gay, and each actor got to play the villain and the victim, depending on which partner they were with. I actually tried to get a trans actor that could play male in one incarnation of it and female in another incarnation of it. And that actually at the time just didn't work out. It was 2018. And I put out so many casting notices for a real trans individual that could flip flop. It didn't matter if it was a trans man or trans woman. And that element just didn't work. But, you know, I wanted to make a piece about the universality of love and emotions, because we all go through the same thing. It doesn't matter if you're gay, if you're straight, if you're trans. We all experience heartbreak. We all experience betrayal. We all experience, you know, whether it's in a romantic relationship or a friendship or a work situation. So that was my last film called Details. And we got to go to the Cannes Film Festival with it. And it screened at the Cambridge Film Festival in UK. And now the piece is a semi-finalist for Best Female Director at the Art House Festival in Beverly Hills, which is really exciting. But, you know, I don't feel like I ever picked these things because they were timely or because they were relevant. It's just stuff that I've experienced. You know, I've met I have friends who are trans. I have friends who are gay. I have friends who are bi. I have friends who've been in polyamorous relationships. Thank you. I'm having trouble with that word. You know what I mean? And everybody has their ups and downs, and, you know, what works for one person doesn't work for the other person. And like I said, you know, everybody deserves to be treated with dignity and respect, and everybody deserves to have their place in the world. But also, my place can't infringe on your place, and yep. Your place can't infringe on mine.
Exactly.
And that's how we get along.
Mm-hmm. And that's something we've forgotten. And here in America, I can't speak for Canada, but we have the most divisive son of a bitch I have ever dealt with in my almost 40 years of life. I've never seen such division in this country than what we're dealing with now. And I'm sure you guys are dealing with the same thing, because Canada is kind of like America Junior in regards to this Nazi.
Yeah, we just follow suit. We follow suit.
Insane. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to get too depressing here, but I do want to ask you a question here, because you are someone who is very open, very honest. You do the one woman show, you put yourself out there. Basically, you're like, here, this is my creation, like it or hate it. I'm just going to put it out there because I'm cool like that. And a lot of people don't have that confidence. And I want to ask you, because I saw this video last week of you on Instagram, and it's like negative 100 degrees in Canada, and you're running around in like a bikini or something, right? I just want to know, like, where did you get this confidence from? Because a lot of people...
So that clip is from my web series.
Yeah.
It's from my web series, Dump Water Divas. And actually, it's really funny. So yeah, that we shot that. That was like 2013. And that was Venice Beach. This is one of like my proudest things that I ever created, even though it was a complete failure. I've made a lot of failures, and that's okay. That's how you get to success. We had no money to make it, like literally no money. And when I say no money, like takes place in a dance studio, and we couldn't afford a dance studio. So we taped tinfoil to the wall in my writing partner's bedroom, moved all her furniture out, and bought rolls of toilet tinfoil from the dollar store, and just taped a bunch of tinfoil. Cause you know, when like mirrors are like cheap and old, they get blurry a little bit. Mm-hmm. So I was like, it could be like a mirror. Like, and my character, I love her. Her name is Christy, and she is a Mormon, a born again Mormon, and she is also an ass to calf model. Not her face, like she wasn't pretty enough to be like an actual model, but because she was a dancer, she's got a great ass to calf. So she's famous from being like a leg model in razor commercials. These are the things I write about, okay?
That's funny, though, because everyone's known for something. I had a hand model on the show not too long ago, so I get it, you know?
So the clip you saw, so one of the things that I decided, because my character was an ass to calf model, is anytime she was like in a leotard or whatever, it would be hiked up her ass. You know, even if it wasn't a thong, it would just, that was her thing. And I sent the clip to I sent it to my writing partner, Rebecca Morgan, a few weeks before I posted it on Instagram. And she started laughing, and she's like, Jen, she's like, nowadays, everybody's like leotard or bathing suit is up the ass. She's like, that's not even a joke anymore, because that's just how everything is cut nowadays. Oh. Yeah. And also I was at least 15 pounds heavier in that video than I was now. So it's not like I have this like, you know, model body or whatever. Like you can't see it from the back, but when I turn around, you can definitely see my tummy. Oh. But whatever. But that's the thing. It's like when you're a comedian, when you're trying to make people laugh, you're going for the laugh. It's not about, oh, do I look hot? Do I look hot? Do I look hot? Mm-hmm. Give me some more Botox.
I saw the video and I'm like, oh my god, please tell me this isn't like recent, because it's so cold. Okay, good. So I'm, at least you were warm when you did.
Yeah, no, that was from years ago, but it's from that was like an outtake from from Dump Water Divas, which till this day, most fun I ever had in my life. The 2 days shooting that video, because my character also talks like this, like total Valley girl, which was also an accident. I was trying to do Mira Sorvino's accent from Romy and Michelle's high school reunion, which I can do that now. But at the time, I kept trying to do that accent, but I wasn't competent back then. You know, she had more of like a California surfer dude accent. Mm-hmm. I was trying to do that, but it didn't work. And it just came out as a Valley girl. But everybody on set, like all the crew, everybody was talking like that by the end of the first day. It was so good.
Speaking of accents, I'm very disappointed because I have not heard one A or any Canadian trope at all. When did you lose that? Or is it just something because like you've been in front of the camera?
Yeah, I think because just having like a standard American accent is pretty, you know, pretty important. Like if I was saying like, hoser from Canada, I don't think I get much acting work. but that's a pretty thick accent. In Toronto, it's so cosmopolitan. Nobody really speaks like that. We will say the A's, and because I've been in Toronto for most of the pandemic, I do say out instead of out. Yeah. Out. We're going out tonight. So certain pronunciations of words. And it's, yeah, it's just funny because even, you know, here everybody says pasta instead of pasta and certain pronunciations. I don't know. But yeah, I lost the Canadian pretty quick when I moved to the States.
I want to ask you about the creative process when you're making these characters. Do you draw them from people that you know in your own personal life, or are they just variations of you? How do you come up with those?
Combinations, definitely combinations of people. So like the Christy character, like the Mormigan, I don't even know where I came up with that idea. I was working with a partner, Rebecca, and it's funny because I always had confidence in my writing. I never thought I would write with a partner. And Rebecca, someone I met in an acting class, and she's just so fabulous and I love her so much. And she's like, hey, my husband bought me a camera. Like, let's write a 5-minute little short film and shoot it. And I was like, okay, because it was her and because I really liked her. But then I realized like how much fun it was to collaborate with somebody else. Mm-hmm. So I've had a couple writing partners at this point. And as much as I'm competent to write on my own, so much fun to play with friends, so much fun. But I don't know. I think the character of Christy wasn't based so much on somebody that I knew, but it was based on the idea of, I recently watched Eyes of Tammy Faye. So like a Tammy Faye Baker type that's like, God wants us to do this. And God told me to do this. And God wants us to win. And, you know, I think I was just kind of playing with that idea of an extreme religious person who's not really a good person, but who just hides behind the cross and hides behind the religion to get away with like abhorrent behavior.
We all know a bunch of those people in our lives, I'm sure.
Yeah. And somebody who was like completely obsessed with fame and self-involved and like didn't really care who she hurt, even though she's like, you know, where's her cross? But Christy, there's a terrible scene. There's like a terror in the opening, the first episode. Our little 5-minute short film turned into a 6-episode web series. You know, she like sucks on her cross and like, Jesus is sexy. Like, you know, in a very provocative way.
That's awesome. So what's it like though? Because, you know, you mentioned going to the award shows, you see, I mean, number one on Amazon has to be the highlight, because you know how much bullshit is on Amazon. You can type literally any word in Amazon and there's 100,000, you know, results for it. And just look at that and be like, all right, how many rom-coms are created a year? How many of these failed books do you think are out there? And you're looking and it's like, wait, I'm number one. Yeah. Can you just kind of like walk us through how that felt?
It was pretty surreal. It was pretty like, I was like, what? Me? But also I've dealt with so many years of like rejection and going unnoticed and so many failures that like at this point, I can't even believe anything I do becomes successful. You know what I mean? Like every time I'm like, what? Me? But yeah, it was pretty surreal. It was a few days before my birthday. It was the night before I went to New York. My birthday's in September. And I was going to New York for the weekend. And it was literally like, you know, 8 o'clock at night before my 6 a.m. flight to New York. And I was pretty thrilled. I had to keep looking at it because I'm like, is this real? And I did have imposter syndrome for like several days. I was like, but it's not, you know,
Is it a typo? Is that really me?
Yeah, exactly. And also because like the initial book was like such a failure, you know, so like launching it with the title, but it's definitely a huge highlight of my life. And what was even crazier was a couple months later, I wrote, because I also have a couple how-to books. One is how to record and publish your audiobook in 7 simple steps. That also hit number one on Amazon. Mm-hmm. And that one was totally surreal because there's a book called The Artist's Way. I'm not sure if you've ever heard of it. But
I haven't read a book in over a decade. Isn't that some sad shit right there?
You're not alone. I know lots of people like you. It's okay. So there's a book called The Artist's Way, which is a pretty famous book for artists, whether you're a musician, whether you're a writer. And it's basically, it has you doing like exercises every day to like tap into your like creative energy. It's a book that not only I've done a couple of times, but I recommend it. I talk about it all the time. I was number one, and that book was number two for like 5 days. And I was just like, what? So like I can't, like, 'cause I took screenshots of like number one and, because there's different categories. That one hit number one in like seven or eight different categories. And the fact that it was number one next to a book that I'm like obsessed with, that's when it all kind of registered. Like, you have arrived, Jennifer.
Like, what's the next day like? Because you hit number one, and it's like you go one day, you're just Jennifer, right? And then the next day, you're Jennifer with the number one book on Amazon. Does your phone start ringing? Do you start getting calls from people that you never thought you'd hear from? Like, how does your life?
Yeah, I definitely heard from a bunch of people that I hadn't heard from in a while, and that's always nice. It's always nice to reconnect with people and to get recognition. And it's also really cool hearing from people who I didn't even know I was on their radar, like in terms of the film business. So that was really crazy for me also, like getting DMs from people that I'm just like, you know I exist.
Pretty new at first, but
So that was pretty special. But I gotta tell you, once I did hit number one the first time, and I was going like the next day, I was going to the airport to go to New York for my birthday. I wore a suit to the airport because, usually I'll like wear yoga pants. So I just want to be comfortable on the flight. I think a lot of us do that nowadays, whereas it used to be an event to fly. People used to like wear their Sunday best to go flying. So I was like, I'm a number one bestseller now. I have to dress the part. So I like wore a suit and I wore like a pair of Oxfords and I wore a fedora and I like totally was like, I'm a best-selling author now. So it did. And that's the other thing too. Like now, not that I've had many interviews because we've been locked down, but now if I'm taking meetings or going to interviews, I kind of think to myself, well, Jennifer, what would a number one best-selling author wear as opposed to like what I would normally wear? Because
exactly.
it's true. And I think, dressing the part, makes you feel a little differently. It makes you comport yourself a little differently. So
Oh, yeah.
yeah, I'm working on that. I'm work like even I went shopping, about a month after that. And I bought things that I wouldn't normally buy because I was like, no. You're a number one best-selling author now. You have to dress differently.
Put down the capris, pick up the business pants. I'm telling you, you got to get with it now. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's so silly, but it is what it is,
Something tells me you're getting in the wrong business. It's something about you is just you're way too nice to be in such a cutthroat business. How do you stay grounded and survive?
Oh, I can be a bitch.
Does the bitch come out when you're at the auditions? It's like, I have to be tough.
No, not at the auditions. The other thing, well, first of all, I'm Canadian, so I am nice. But when I lived in New York for like almost 6 years, and I used to joke that I was like the only rude Canadian. Like, that New York rubbed off on me. And it's funny because when I was younger and when I first started producing and I was running this theater company in New York, I was so young. And really, it was all beyond my capability. And I didn't know how to manage stress. I didn't know how to manage a company. I didn't know how to talk to people. And I look back on those days and I'm like, wow, like if I ran into any of those people today, I would be horrified to know what they thought of me back then because I was a raging bitch. Like, just too much stress, too much responsibility, too many things on my plate that I didn't know how to deal with it. But also, I think because I got that experience super young, fast forward to now, like my rules on set, my number one rule, if you're not having fun, you're fired. Like we're going to work hard. We're going to bust our asses. We're going to be working like 14, 18 hour days, but we are going to have a good time while we're doing it. And I think I just kind of developed the skills to be able to be grace under fire and be gracious and have fun with it and not to sweat the small stuff and to choose my battles a little more. But yeah, I can get down to business when I need to. Like I said, I was an athlete. I used to be a beast. Like
the competitive spirit never dies.
Exactly. And I think that's why, like, I was like such a big, we've talked about Buffy before. Like I'm such a big Buffy fan because it's like, I was this little girl, you know, but like powerful and like could tumble and chin-ups, push-ups, like all the, you know, cause we have to do all that conditioning and training to be able to have the muscles and the ability to do all the tricks and the flips and everything. So I always, even though I've always been a small little package, I've always felt like really fierce and really strong. And I've even like broken up fights on the subway between people. Like I am not afraid to like get in people's shit.
We need more people like that out there, because I'm going to tell you something. Every time I watch a video of a fight on the subway, there's like 100 people that could help someone out. And it seems like the smallest person's always getting the shit kicked out of them. And everyone around them has got their phones up there, like sitting there recording it. So you actually get in there and you're scrappy. You fight and you help the small people out. I appreciate that.
Yeah. I remember one time I was on my way to Queens to a production meeting. It was like after midnight. I was young. I was running this little theater company and we all worked in the restaurants, you know, so we would have our production meeting, you know, you get off the restaurant at midnight and you're wired. You're not going to bed till like 3-4 in the morning. Anyways, you don't have to be at work till 4 in the afternoon. So I just had a long day. And it was two black kids. They were teenagers and this old man, like he was probably in his 50s, but at the time I just thought he was like this really old man, you know. Now that I'm getting a little older, I'm like, 50's not that old. But you know, when I was 20, it was like ancient. Mm-hmm. And it was this man who was just being so racist and like harassing them verbally and like, you know, and the kids were retaliating to defend themselves. I didn't know who started it. I didn't know what was going on. It was happening when I walked on the subway and like a few stops happened and I'm looking around and I'm like, there's black people, there's white people, there's all these different people late night on the subways, like Saturday night. And I'm just like, nobody's doing anything. Nobody's doing anything. And I just exploded. And I'm like, I've had enough of your shit. And these kids are like, he started it. It wasn't us. He started. And I was like, I don't give a shit who started it. I'm going to finish it right now. Shut the fuck up. I've had a long day. I'm not dealing with your bullshit. And I just unloaded.
Yeah.
And, you know, the kids were like, and then the old man was giving me like dirty, like he wanted to beat me up. Like, cause he, you know, he was targeting them. He wanted a fight. And he was looking for a fight, but he wasn't going to fight me. And, you know, the subway, I was going all the way to last stop in Queens, Ditmars on the N train. And the subway started emptying out and this old guy's still there. And I'm like, oh my God, like, is he going to end up like beating me up when everybody leaves? Anyway, he ends up leaving. It's me. And then it's a couple with their two teenage children. And they're like, oh my God, we're from Canada. This was so cool. We just had our first New York moment on the subway.
Proud of it.
And I'm like, oh my God, where are you from? I'm Canadian. And they're like, what? And, you know, they tell me their name and they tell me where I'm from. And I'm like, oh, I'm, you know, I tell them my name. They're like a Jewish family from Canada visiting like a niece who moved to New York. And I'm like, yeah, I'm a Jewish girl from Toronto. And the mother just went white, you know, because I was like 21 years old. And she's like, my daughter is 19. Like I could never imagine her being like you in 2 years. And she was just like horrified.
That's scary.
Horrified by the size of my balls.
That's scary. It says more about the mom, because the mom's like, listen, my kid doesn't have any guts because of me. I didn't raise her to have guts. So that's more of an indictment on the mom, if anything.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's the thing. Like, I always, like, I've always been super ballsy. I've always been assertive. I've always had the courage or the confidence to like speak my mind. And I think it's the Libra in me that always has to stand up for justice, even if it has nothing to do with me. I just kind of like have that, you know, conviction.
Of course. Listen, we talked last, and it was last summer. It was maybe August. I think it was. We were talking about Buffy the Vampire Slayer, right? August. And I told you I was going to rewatch the show because I couldn't remember too much. Now, I did rewatch that and Angel, but I only got up to season 5 in Buffy because something happens where I just shut off and I can't do anymore. I don't know what it is.
It's funny because I rewatched seasons 1 through 3, and I got to say, season 5, you know, with the whole Glory storyline, is like when the Spike and Buffy storyline starts to heat up. So for me, because I love the Spike and Buffy storyline, like season 6 and 7 are like my faves. Mm-hmm. But it's true. You can't, like, if you're trying to rewatch the whole season, it's pretty hard. And season 1 was actually hard for me to get through just because it's so far away from where the show ended.
Yeah.
And it was juvenile, but at the same time, the characters were so much younger and they were, you know, in their sophomore year of high school. So of course, like, all of their problems and everything are so totally, you know, trite compared to, not trite with the monsters and stuff, but just like the high school, you know, scenario stuff was less interesting for me to watch than like getting into the, you know, after Buffy's mom dies and she has to work, make a living. She can't barely keep the house. Yeah. The relationship stuff gets more tumultuous and crazy.
Great series. I have to finally watch to see how it ended, because I know, because of spoilers and obviously time passed, and I just kind of saw how the series ended, but I never saw it.
Season 6 is so good.
Really? See, maybe I'll give it, just because of you, I'm gonna give it a chance again.
Okay, so the end of season 5, spoilers, but you know what? This is 20 years ago, peeps.
Yeah.
You know, so did you watch to the end of season 5?
I did.
Okay, so you see that Buffy dies, mm-hmm. and then episode 1 of season 6, Willow, the mighty Wicca.
She conjured her back, right? She brought her back.
Resurrects Buffy.
Yeah.
You know, and seeing Buffy struggle through season 6 is phenomenal, because none of her friends know that she was in heaven. So all of her friends think they brought her back from some terrible hell dimension. Meanwhile, she was in heaven
with
and
Angel,
they brought her back to face demons every single day again. Where she was like, I was done. I was at peace. I was happy. And now all of my friends brought me back here and they expect me to be like jumping up and down for joy and excited. And she can't tell them.
That's really deep shit right there. I'm telling you, that was one of the best character driven series of all time, because every character you really did care about. That sounds really interesting. I think I'm going to pick up.
Yeah. So then you don't know anything about like the Buffy and Spike relationship and how they become lovers and it's all wrapped up in this storyline, and it's all wrapped up in how she can't confide in her friends about what really happened to her.
And it only went to,
and how she's pissed at them,
right?
For bringing her back.
I'd be pissed too.
Because her work was over. Oh, yeah. Oh, season 6. And then season 7, you know, gets a little like off track. I still like season 7. It took me a while to get into it because there are all these like potential slayers that are popping up and whatever, but it turns into a really good season as well.
You know what? I owe it to myself. I have to finish the damn season. I have to finish.
I think once you start watching, if you get into like 2 episodes of season 6, you'll breeze through six and seven. You'll be like, okay, I gotta keep going now.
Just because of you, I'm gonna do it. But I only have two more questions here for you, okay? Just to close this out, because time flies when we're talking, obviously. It always just does. And we could talk all night long, obviously. But you were so busy. You got so much stuff that going on that I have to let you go eventually. So I do have a couple closing questions here for you. And one of the ones I want to ask you here is just a simple question, but it might require some thinking, okay? So I'm going to give you some time to think about your answer.
Okay.
So out of all the things you do, 800 things that you're good at, right? If you had to fail at every single one of them, but succeed in one, which one would you choose to succeed in and why?
Acting.
Really? Okay. So
that's a no-brainer.
All your books fail. You can never write again. Just acting.
Acting. My favorite thing. Getting to play, whether it's dramatic work, whether it's Shakespeare, whether it's, like running with my ass showing as an ass to calf model. Yes, that is my favorite, most fun, most joyous thing that I get to do with my life. Yes, acting for sure.
Is there like a dream role or part for you that
we already talked about this. So one of them is Buffy the Vampire.
There we go.
The vampire where she gets sired to save her life and has to and now she's evil. And her friends have to deal with that.
That'd be really
bad. And try and figure out, what to do. Like, do they kill her? Do they try and get her a soul like Angel and Spike, because you don't know about Spike.
I was gonna say, don't stop right there, don't go too far. I want to get rough because it does sound good. I have a couple hours before,
so that's a dream role. I also I love Shakespeare, and one of my dream roles is to play Cleopatra in Antony and Cleopatra.
Okay.
Which I just think she's one of the most powerful female characters in Shakespeare. I know Lady Macbeth is very powerful as well, but Cleopatra's not as dark. That's more of a love story, and I love the romance thing. That's definitely another dream role of mine. And just getting to do some really wacky comedy stuff. I love comedy also. Like, I really love doing both.
It's a really good answer though. And you know what? I appreciate that, because you're so good at so many things. It's hard to pin things down. There's not many people built like you. Some people have one talent, you've got many. So to simmer it down to just one as quickly as you did, it means that you're dedicated to acting. And I really see it going far for you.
I just shot two Shakespeare auditions today. I still am in class. I still do vocal exercises every day, and I'm ready. Like, when that role comes, I'm ready. Like, I don't need a week at the gym to get in shape, so to speak, with the acting stuff. It's I'm working on it every day, every week. I don't let a week go by where I'm not working on pieces. I read either a play or a screenplay every single week out loud with one of my writing partners. We've been doing that for 4 years. So you can imagine we've read hundreds of plays and screenplays at this point.
Yeah. I had plenty of time to do it over the past couple of years, but now that everything's reopening and I have a feeling USA and Canada are next, because all these other countries are starting to say no more restrictions. Even Boris Johnson's like, we're done with this shit. And he was one.
Everybody's burnt out. I've got screen fatigue. I don't want to do another meeting I want to see people. I want to be able to smell them and touch them. And you know what I mean? I want, I miss that whole sensorial experience of being around people, for better or for worse,
So do you have anything coming up? Because that was my last question. Do you have anything in the works now that you're working on? Anything we should be watching out for?
Well, I have a new novel that's going to be coming out this year. But it's not ready yet. So I don't want to say too much about it until it is released, but I'm expecting it'll be released spring, summer. I thought Year of the Bitch was going to be my next book that comes out, but sometimes things tell you when they're ready, and Year of the Bitch will be coming out either late 2022, early 2023. but I have a very tumultuous, dramatic romance that is going to be coming out within the next few months.
I love it. And you got to come back here the second it's ready and tell us all
about it. I would love to. I would absolutely love to. It's always a pleasure chatting with you.
Absolutely. And I just want you to just let people know where they can find you and buy all your books and everything, Jennifer Lieberman.
Yes. So all the books are available on Amazon. Year of the What is also available on audio and everywhere that books are sold. You can find me on my website, JenniferLiebermanActor.com. On all social media, I am Jen Lieberman. So the at symbol, I am Jen Lieberman. And I also have a website called Make Your Own Break. I have a vlog that I post there for production advice. And I have a production consulting business. I do some filmmaking workshops for people who don't know how to make their own projects. Very basic stuff, helping writers and actors make vehicles for themselves with little resources and limited resources. So if you're a writer or an actor struggling, you haven't had that break yet, I can teach you how to make your own break.
I love it. It's awesome. My all-time favorite guest, ladies and gentlemen. It's great that we actually put this one out.
Okay. Yes.
It's going to be great. We had some technical issues last time, but this time everything is perfect and good, and you better come back. I'm going to hold you to that, all right?
Yes, I will. I expect to be invited back when I have some new material, for sure.
Absolutely. I can't wait to see your name number one again on Amazon. It's going to be amazing.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Nerd. Well, have a great night. It's always a pleasure chatting with you.
Absolutely, Jennifer. My pleasure. Check her out, guys. Links in the description of the podcast. Have a good night.